Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
Good day, everybody. Glad to have you aboard. And if you are with us live, I'd like to do my usual altar call and extend to you an invitation to join us in the chat room. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, that's where you will find the chat room. And Paul is there along with another fella. As usual, and you're free to join the conversation there if you have some observations you would like to share or perhaps even some topics or questions you wanted us to address to our guests during the course of the next hour. That is the perfect place to do it. And if you don't already, I'd also give you the invitation to go over to Spotify, Spreaker, iTunes, wherever you aggregate your podcasts. If you don't already, go ahead and subscribe to Midrats. It's free. Can't beat the price. And that way, if you got a busy day, at the Midrats will still be waiting for you when you have time in your schedule. And on today's show, we're going to look at mostly the source of the conversation. I know a few years ago, back in 2010, when I was looking for to some of the challenges that were experienced in the 1920s, I called the Terrible 20s, I was looking at some of the challenges the Royal Navy was having. With their budget and their ship programming. And as we had seen, a lot of the problems that come from the mother country, they start to manifest themselves in the U.S. just a few years later. And the communication goes back and forth. And we want to look at, we'll start there with the Royal Navy and some of the challenges they have in Great Britain, but and how that also replicates itself across some of the closer parts of the Anglosphere and her children, really, United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other nations, about an issue that in the last few decades, a lot of people have talked about it, a lot of people have appreciated it, but trying to get through a very frustrating thing for those that understand the importance of sea power in our economies and our global trade, and that is sea blindness. We want to look at where that term came to be used, what are some of the manifestations of it, and not just in Great Britain, but also in the United States and other countries. And we have as our guest for the full hour, Dr. James W.E. Smith, the Lawton Corbett Research Fellow in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. And we're going to talk about a few articles and works of his and others during the course of the show. And you can go over to the podcast show page. We'll have links to those as we go forward. James, welcome to Midrats.
It's a great pleasure today to join you.
We really appreciate you taking time to join us today. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to regulars on Midrats, they've heard us mention sea blindness over the years on occasion. And we never really properly gave its pedigree, where it came from. And in some ways, we speak about it as if people really understand the definition. And that's not really true for those that don't soak themselves on a daily basis on issues involving sea power. If you could please, as you've done really well in a couple of your articles, talk about the origin of the modern term sea blindness and how it started to manifest itself.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating term because to some degree it's rather much of a made-up term because when I tried to say, well, what was the definitive definition of it, there really wasn't one. It was one that had seemingly been increasingly thrown about in the past 40 years to, I think, become an excuse in which to just say, well, this is an umbrella term that we've got a problem here in understanding why it looks like the navies and sea have been devalued ultimately at a national level with our nations, an understanding of what the navies do, why we have a navy, and so on, had kind of been struggling. So this term had really started picking up from about 1980, 1981 in the UK, where at the time it was really bounded around from the Chief of Defence Staff, Terry Lewin, who at the time was dealing with a Conservative government who, led by a former Army officer, John Knott, as Defence Secretary, was really about to cut the Royal Navy to the point of being nothing more than a glorified Coast Guard. And it kind of came up with this term to say, well, an attack on the Navy is sea blindness, that basically the government and the public don't understand what the role of the sea is, what the Navy does. And it started picking up traction then again in the late 1980s, because, of course, Britain had the 1982 Falklands War, and it seemed for a while that government policy would ultimately go back and head in a maritime direction, and that's actually not what it did. So in some degree, the term was almost like a stopgap solution, an umbrella term to sort of raise the alarm that something quite wasn't right and something far more sort of dangerous, at least to Britain as an island, was going on. And I think what has happened over the past sort of 40 years of using this term, it's actually covered up the truth. It's become an excuse, if you like, because we've not torn away past the layers to find out, okay, what is going on here? Why is this apparent devaluation, not interest in the Navy, however you want to put it? What's going on? And it seems they'd rather use that, the sea blindness, and say, well, the public don't understand, the government doesn't understand, so we'll use this term, rather than say, how did we get from A to B for this to happen? So I've been slowly peeling back these layers, and I got back to the 1980s, 1981, where it seemed to take form, and then said, well, okay, how did we get to this point?
Well, let's ask the rest of the question. How do we get to this point? What in the world? What is it that drives turning a blind eye, to use an Nelsonian phrase, turning a blind eye to the Navy, has happened in both England and in the U.S.
I think I would say the term sea blindness is ultimately an excuse for failure. And what do I mean by that? It's hiding the truth that, and not explaining the problem, that there has been a breakdown in communicating the role of the sea power in the nation and what a Navy does. It sounds a ridiculously simple question. What does the Navy do? But actually, if you ask around, many don't know how to answer that question. And then it's, well, people don't understand what the sea is about. So although it was never properly quantified, really what is behind this is the ability to educate our decision makers, our most senior decision makers, to communicate what the Navy is for, why maritime strategy matters. And it's far easier, I think, sometimes, instead of saying, how has the systems that we once had, why have they broken down? Where's the communication breakdown here? And why have we ended up in this problem? So I think there's another side of that. There's a notion, and particularly in Britain, that the government or parliament should just get the sea. Is a little bit misleading, because I've always argued, look, we as humans are land dwellers. We might work at sea, but we're land dwellers. And that's what we understand. It's not easy to show what the Navy does, type of thing. So as we look back, we start trying to look at, where did the communication break down? What were the things that slowly started eroding it? And particularly in Britain, this really comes back to the 1960s. You had an Admiralty for 300 years who took on the task of, and civilians in the Admiralty, of communicating to parliamentarians, to the cabinet, the prime minister, what the Navy was for at a base level. And the naval officer really was not involved in that process. That's how you actually end up with the best Navy, is you let the naval officers get on with the job, and the civilians in the Admiralty basically tell the government why you've got a Navy, what it needs, and why maritime strategy is the best option for an island. And in the 1960s, with the creation of Unified Defence, that's the creation of things like the UK Ministry of Defence, obviously in the United States, the DOD, those mechanisms for communicating these things are torn apart. And in the case of Britain, overnight, Royal Navy officers are put in charge of all of that, and they don't have a clue what to do. So how we've ended up in the 2020s with the question, what does the Royal Navy do, has been this sort of slow burning devaluation, unable to communicate, and it's all sort of snowballed. So it was quite, for my research, it was quite a mission to try and take all of this apart, because there is, when you say, well, the devaluation of the sea, you come up against other things like, well, look, humans aren't moving across the Atlantic and ocean liners anymore. So there's another side of this, which is people are flying. They don't come into contact with ships and civilian ships very much anymore. Prime example. So there are lots of moving parts in all of this, which have roots to their acceleration definitely in the 1950s and 60s.
I want to quote here a little bit from your article that came out on 19th February, Sea Blindness in the Royal Navy Today, that really it hit home with me, because one thing that Mark and I have talked about in Midrats for a long period of time is when it comes to national security issues, and you know that includes the maritime umbrella, a conversation is taking place. But the issue is who is showing up for the conversation and why are they showing up there? And on the American side of the pond, and you know, you mentioned the British version of that started in the 60s with the consolidation under MOD, is for mostly bureaucratic reasons, at for the convenience of politicians, is the creative friction in the marketplace of ideas on what is the best way to invest the government's funds to secure the peace and prosperity of a nation, given the challenges it faces. That creative friction, people say, well, that takes place behind closed doors. That may sound true unless you've actually been behind the closed doors and you see that conversation doesn't take place, because it's who gets invited behind the closed doors. And something that was really shocking, and whenever I'm in London, I always go to Trafalgar Square. I got to, wave a hat to the man. But you made a good point towards the end. I'm going to do a little quote for somebody, quote you a little bit, so people who are listening that they want to read the whole thing, they can go read the article. But the last paragraph of your article, in two parts, I'll combine the two, quote, "Some have argued Lord Nelson would have been all over social media to advertise the Royal Navy, yet this ignores the fact that the organization of how modern defense works would never permit such an individual to flourish today. The root cause of sea blindness is that the ability, tools, and methods of educating about sea power and maritime strategy to Parliament, government, and the Ministry of Defense has been destroyed. This is the fundamental problem. So bemoaning why the public and government, quote, do not get sea power, unquote, means little and demonstrates how unserious some are when so few understand the issue or want to acknowledge how deep the problem goes." You touched on it real briefly in your answer to the last question, but institutionally, because a lot of what you talk about in the UK always also applies here in the States, intellectually, what have we lost?
I think this is an important, actually, difference between the US and the UK, and this is an applied history sort of scenario where for 300 years, the Admiralty at the heart of Whitehall has essentially communicated and educated, I think that's the key word actually in this, educated, cabinet, prime ministers, engaged with parliamentarians of all sides and arguments about simple things, like what is the Navy for? And what happens in the 1960s is those entire mechanisms are torn down and they're not replaced. So where before you have that institutional memory, and this is why I think it's so crucial to talk about this, you end up with 300 years of institutional memory of experience. And overnight, that gets thrown away. It's not replicated in the Ministry of Defense, because unified defense is about political power and financial control. I think that's one thing that I try to communicate to everybody. The high levels of whether that's the DOD or the MOD, they're not there to serve the military. They're there to serve political power and keep civilian control. So inherently, these are individuals who are not educated on all the 900 million different bits of jargon, technocratic discussion, and everything we have to talk about. They are simply there to ensure that civilian control, treasury control, and they need to be educated. Now, that's a major problem if you transform your system in the case of the UK, where you have civilians in the Admiralty, as well as scholars and an intellectual forum outside of that to go out and educate them. Now, when most of that is transferred over to ultimately naval officers, there's a civil military question there, because ultimately the government can turn around and tell your naval personnel to shut up. So this whole system of talking about sea power, and I said it's never, and I said in I think elsewhere in the article, is not dependent on the naval officer. It's dependent on a range of things educating, is dissolved overnight in the case of the UK between 1962 and 64. So really, your parliamentarians who are going to make decisions, who are going to influence the Treasury, overnight end up basically knowing, well, what does the Royal Navy do? And then Royal Navy officers try to answer that, and they don't know how to do it because they've never done it for basically 350 years. So that's kind of where I think the decades afterwards of problems and issues and all these debates about the Royal Navy are flown from, really come down to that very simple change, but is actually very fundamental. You can't overnight just throw away 300 years worth of institutional memory and experience and somehow expect the system that takes over to instantly understand. You're back at, to use an expression, ground zero. So that's kind of the very basic version of what's I think going on.
Yeah, in your article from February 27th of this year, and U.S. Navy versus sea blindness, you said par for the course for America. Talk about what you have also called the natural bias away from the sea that seems to erupt every now and then in the U.S. and causes some significant concerns about where we're going with our Navy.
Yeah, I think to emphasize the point here is to look at and remember that, I don't need to tell your audience properly, the United States is a continental country that's seemingly flanked by two large oceans, and this creates a bit of a confusion in Washington, D.C., because the argument there is that large continental countries are going to think in land-centric terms all the time. In the U.K., the Royal Navy is the senior service because before we even have some form of a written inverted commas constitution, the Crown has identified national security, defense, prosperity is dependent on the creation of a naval power. In the United States, I think the U.S. Navy foundationally, and particularly when the U.S. Naval War College is founded, it is an admittance that the value of sea power to America has to be communicated and consistently communicated. So there is a major difference here, where in Britain, that maritime strategy for an island nation, which has developed because of the geographic realities of being an island, going the opposite direction, which is we fake it as a continental power, versus the United States goes through a period and saying, well, initially we're starting out as a nation, then in the later 1800s, this sea power stuff basically is really good for defending America and its interests, and then the systems are put in place. There's things like the U.S. Naval Institute, U.S. Navy League. These are all parts of the mechanisms to keep that sea power agenda going. But whether you're an island or you're a continent, there's always, I mentioned earlier, this bias towards the land. You know, we live in houses on the land. It's very hard to show what the Navy does. And also, as part of that, navies are long-term pieces of the state's apparatus, usually. Yes, nowadays they can deliver results quite quickly, but you're playing a long-term chess game normally with them. This is not an overnight matter in their use. So how do you show a politician what the Navy does? Because day in, day out, we know navies are going about their business. The great historian Sir Julian Corbett made the point, look, navies very rarely fight battles, to be honest. So our decision makers are actually thinking, well, what's this about? How do you show that to them? You can drive a tank to a DC if you want, maybe not a good idea, but you can show them aircraft, you can show them tanks, you can show them troops, you can show them exercise. It's a lot harder to do that with sea power. So in the United States, there is this active effort by both naval officers and civilian supporters to try and say, look, this is really good for the nation, how this is how it benefits America, and you maintain those systems. And part of what happens in the 1940s and 1950s is an attempt to protect those systems, which is why I think the U.S. Navy actually ends up in a far better position than the Royal Navy does.
You know, the commonalities, I think there's also a difference where, at least from the American perspective, I find it even more perplexing that Britain has such a hard time making the argument for sea power, because as you rightly, you know, outline, it is a true island nation, not the United States, which is cosplaying a maritime nation simply because Canada and Mexico are friends to the north and the south. We don't really think of ourselves as a continental nation. It's the waters on either side. And part of that difference in what's perplexing is the fact, and I like what you brought up in an article that you also put out in February titled The U.S. versus Sea Blindness, Par for the Course for Americans. And again, we'll have this link for everybody. But in the early part, you outline where, quote, while the British felt the immense weight of history on their shoulders, where a rightful paranoia has grown in the British public mindset prior to 45, that failure at sea meant most certain national doom, the Americans could isolate themselves where the fundamental ingredients in national survival, such as fuel, resources of food, could be provided and kept relatively secure inland, far removed from the sea. That's one thing as Americans I don't think we really appreciate, but I know that at the edge of living memory, just like the Dutch remember their famine of 44, and my introduction to this was in the dog world, where there are some of my favorite dog breeds are very rare nowadays because a lot of them, like the Sussex Spaniel, barely survived World War II. Right on the edge of living memory, lack of a secure access to sea came very close to starving Britain, and now you are a nation with a much greater population and even more interdependencies. Outside of the politics that take place in the Ministry of Defense, where do you see some of the failures in explaining this to the British people and their elected representatives, the importance the sea still remains to the United Kingdom?
I think there's naturally, because we always speak in naval terms, we look at this as kind of a naval problem, but it's far beyond that. It's when we think about our society, our communities, our countries today, what I've always put down as the first thing, saying, well, how much does the public actually interact with the sea or understand goods are coming over the sea? I've sort of in some of the articles pointed out, really, the public only start getting interested in what happens at sea when the price of fuel goes up 50 pence. Or their grocery store bill goes up. That's when it hits them. The rest of the time, they've got not a clue by how, in the case of Britain in particular, those resources are coming in and out of the country. And there's one I mentioned earlier. We've got a public today which, if they want to go anywhere, they catch a plane or a train. So their interaction with the sea is quite low, where before we have, you went back 100 years, you know, you wanted to cross the Atlantic, you're going an ocean liner. You're just naturally going to be mixing with the sea, merchant, civilian, however you want to put it, a lot more than today. The other part is now teaching generations are now, and we've got to the situation where I'm probably like yourself, I'm from a generation who had contact with generations from the First and Second World War who taught us these things or reminded us of these things. And now we've got a younger generation coming through who will not have that. And I think that these sort of things are really important because that also drives the political agenda. We do have an element, particularly in Britain, I think to some degree in the United States, about sea power versus land-based air power as well, which is a big matter. In the 1950s, the RAF were very, very good at basically attempting to push away the most core tenant. The Royal Navy prevents invasion, just as it had with Lord Nelson, just as it actually did in the Second World War. And they attempt to change that whole thing and saying, well, look, air power and land-based aircraft have changed this. You know, ships are irrelevant. Forget about that. Move on. And actually, when you start to put all these things together, and there's quite a list of things that I know I drew and said put that together, you end up with this snowball effect where actually navies are made particularly in the 1940s and 1950s, to look irrelevant. And to some degree, they've never recovered from that, because the argument was always undermined that, well, the public is only going to start saying, well, look, we're getting upset that the price of our fuel at the fuel pump is going up and our grocery store is going up. And there is now no voices in Parliament who are, again, are educated to turn around and say, well, hang on a moment. That's actually because we've had a ship sunk and ships are going a different way, so it's pushing all the prices up. And we've got to such a low point now, there aren't parliamentarians to turn around or internally say, well, that's the reason. And, of course, that allows you to sit and say, well, you know, we need a navy to protect that. That's all fallen apart. And this is why I've been trying to push forward and say, this is very much, in the case of Britain, a ground zero situation. Because if you have your parliamentarians and your government not willing to stand up and say, look, the economy is in danger, our resources are in danger because of X, Y, Z is happening out on the oceans, which is increasingly a chaotic situation, then that is admitting complete and utter failure to communicate what the Navy is for. And then we've really got to start ultimately pointing fingers and asking very deep questions about what's going on here.
Is there, I think you hinted at this, and maybe even said it more correctly than that, is there a anti-colonialism aspect to the people who are bad-mouthing or questioning the need for a Navy that they can't understand how it works, but they understand, you know, because of the far-flung colonies that Great Britain used to have are no more, and that was one of the reasons for having the Navy you had. Is there an anti-colonial aspect to some bias against the Navy?
I think this is where what happened in the 1960s was there was a concerted effort, particularly by civilian historians, to rewrite history. And that was the manipulation, essentially, of what had happened in the 20th century with British strategy. So ultimately, the argument that's put forward is saying Britain had committed large amounts of land-based forces to Europe. And obviously, with the empire being dissolved, the reason that the Navy existed was to maintain that empire and protect essentially the sea lanes of communication between them and everything else. And that's not what's important to the nation now. The nation now is best served by, as Sir Michael Howard put it, a continental commitment. So historians, I think, generally jumped on this bandwagon, and they also started talking about, and I find this greatly frustrating, a golden age of navies, which, of course, for Britain will always be basically Lord Horatio Nelson in 1805. But that period in which the Royal Navy is doing imperial policing, if you like, to put it in those terms, in Pax Britannia, is quite a small period after that point in which the nation had been secured. And already those connections of empire are under attack in the beginning of the 20th century. And all of this combined was sending a message that the Royal Navy was basically an imperious tool. To some degree, calling it the senior naval service made it sound like something that needed to be retired. And from that, there was this whole picture painted, particularly by senior army officers and veterans and RAF officer veterans in the 1950s, that this was an outdated, basically, service. It has no relevancy to a Britain that's ultimately standing alone. It doesn't have an empire to support. The counter-argument to that, of course, was our geographic reality of an island had not changed in the slightest. So at the beginning of the 1960s, the British Admiralty actually start pushing back on this quite aggressively and are quite successful, which underlines when unified defense came in a few years later, all those arguments were lost. So there's been this concoction of things going on in which you would say an actual, and what is British sea power? Well, British sea power is the 1500s through to 1805. It's how does an island that's got very few resources, barely any finances, that's how islands are generally always poor, what's the best solution here? How do we first defend the island? Because culturally, there's always going to be that question of how do we stop ourselves being invaded? Because islands are easy to invade by superior forces of continentals because they have more resources. So, of course, that changes a little bit again with the arrival of the nuclear deterrent. But then on top of that, it's the question comes of, okay, what do we want, a maritime strategy? We want a continental strategy. And historians jump on this and convince the government that really, well, look, the Navy is purely an imperialist tool. It needs to, the Royal Navy needs to be nothing more than consigned to the to doing some tasks in the North Atlantic. And, of course, the United States will be the premier sea power now with global power. So there is a rewriting of history in the 1960s, which essentially picks 300 years of British strategic experience and purposely throws it away. And behind all of it is things like the commitment of troops in the trenches in the First World War and everything else, which I think can be hardly said was a success at the end of the day. So, yes, to answer your question, yes, it's that connection and a forced connection that sea power is just an imperialist tool. It's very fundamental to arguments against the Navy.
It's almost like you have a perfect storm where, you know, you discussed how Corbett used the machinery, the admiralty to, and the network of civilians to communicate the role of the Navy. And you discussed earlier in the hour about how that's, and in your article, how that is being muzzled and muted, that avenue, something that Nelson would have done as well. But, you know, you talked about the 1960s and what happened to history. And for the listeners, I would, and again, this is cross-pond issue. It's really a problem in the entire English-speaking world. But if they can just Google American Historical Association Conference Agenda, it got done last January in San Francisco. Look through the panel discussions there. And what you see, and this has been around for a long time, is what people would think is history. It isn't. It's a lot of oppressor versus oppressed, derivative Marxist philosophy, critical theory. There, the discussion of history has really become hyper-political in a lot of reasons, which is, again, is nothing new. I remember when I asked one of my professors in the mid-80s about getting a PhD in history. he gave me advice of what he saw was going to happen in the future, and he was exactly right. But it seems like there's been a failure of, if not individual historians, but the institutions of historians and how we treat history, how we study history, how we talk about history and the lessons. It seems less about that and more about other disciplines.
I think if it has to reflect, I would just say this. If in Britain, is there an intellectual forum to really reflect using the applied history school on military history? Is there the ability to have a serious discussion about sea power, the Navy, and so on and so forth? My answer is going to be no. That's part of the problem. Part of it is to do with, is there actually is so much to study. In the case of the Royal Navy, if we go right the way back to when King Henry VIII founded the service, to understand what our national strategy should be, which is maritime, you have to go back to the 1500s and work forward, because as Sir Julian Corbett did, he analyzed all of this 100 years of experience and said, this is how we came up with a national strategy. We had all the strategic experience, and that is understood by 1910. He puts that as a historian into something the government can understand, and the government pays attention to it. The really interesting point about that is, ironically, it gets thrown away at the beginning of the First World War because of the weakness of naval officers. In the meeting in cabinet when the First World War starts, the government has a plan which is built on 300 years of maritime strategy. It's that an island nation does not get embroiled into a continental fight. It can't do it. It can't sustain a large army. Britain doesn't have a big army. People forget Parliament has to renew even the reason for having an army every single year. It's that we're going to have to do the maritime strategy we've always done, economic blockade. We have a highly professional army that's going to put pinpoint pressure at places, and we're going to build that continental alliances. As we can argue later, would be then the United States coming in, and we're bringing in those things that we can do and applying those pressure points on who we're fighting. But all of that requires a deep study and understanding of history, and we don't have that. Looking specifically, and that's not taught anymore, it's applied history. What we have now is different. We have political science heavily involved in war studies. We have international relations studied in it, and then we have historians. The historians are really fighting a bit of an uphill battle over applied history now. My counter-argument to this is all experience is all we've got. Everything else is theory, guesswork, and assumptions. If you're trying to defend a nation and its interests, and you want to build your policies on theory and guesswork and assumptions, you're playing a very, very dangerous game. And why would you want to? If you've got hundreds of years of strategic experience, this is low-hanging fruit on the tree, if you like. It's free knowledge. So on one hand, you have a civilian matter, which is the study of history, and there are quite a few elements of that as well, whether or not how that's taught at universities. Also, how is that taught at schools with younger people again? Is there career paths for historians? No. Is there career paths for historians to aid the military and head in a defense direction? No. There's then a professional discussion on the other side. And in the case of Britain, I'm going to separate Britain out from the United States from this. Do we have an intellectual forum to discuss the Royal Navy constructively? No, we don't. And the scholars, the amount of scholars involved in that now are very far and few between. And also, is there a willingness by the Navy to some degree? Does it have the time and resources to engage with those scholars? No. And this is a serious problem, because for navies, we know this because of civil military reasons, your civilians and your veterans are what your main mechanism to some degree to communicate what the Navy does. Because ultimately a naval officer cannot go against government policy. I as an academic can then say, oh, I think that's a good idea, I think that's a bad idea, and so on and so forth. So there's quite a few moving parts in that. It's not easy. And I think what we've also seen in, I would say, more navalist-driven discussions recently is a very technical discussion, but the more sort of philosophical side of maritime strategy, the cultural one, the one that you need to have to answer to government, this is why we have a Navy, are no longer being served. And I've argued, you've read in those papers, actually that's question number one you answer and your technical discussion happens later. Ultimately, the government and the public don't understand this stuff. They don't need to know this stuff. They don't need to read the Naval Institute proceedings. They just want some simple answers, which is why their taxes are going on this and how it offers them the best option. And we don't have a forum to in the UK to provide those answers. I think if I was to look at the United States to provide some balance here, the reason in the 1940s and 1950s the U.S. Navy responds to how the Department of Defense is constructed, if you like, and the mechanisms within it. Part of them are to do with to ensure there is ability to communicate what its mission is. And it has things it protects, and people invest in, like the Navy League and the Naval Institute, to have forums and mechanisms which are independent to keep speaking out about it, because there's been generations building up saying, we know in a continental country our Navy is lower down on the priority list. This is where it makes the British situation really interesting, because, of course, suddenly we're presented with, well, the Navy is the priority, and it's not, even though our geographic realities remain the same, which is where you have to say, then, what is going on intellectually to get to a point where you're grabbing those key arguments, geographic realities, low resources, low finances, and so on and so forth, and nobody's standing up and saying, sorry, when did Britain stop being an island type of thing? So the historians being, I think, pushed out of the conversation is really important, and I can say in the strongest term, because we do not have an intellectual forum in the UK, that's half of our problem at the moment.
Yeah, I have a theory that part of what happened is that the things have run so relatively smoothly in the last 50 years or 60 years that nobody pays attention to see, because it's just been kind of automatic. And I think you kind of point out the difficulty with that in that usually don't read a long quote, but I'm going to read this quote because it's a really good one. The global order in the high seas, that the global order in the high seas is dependent or be dependent on the American nation with its natural bias away from the sea and instead favors Prussian terms of land warfare should alarm other powers that have an interest in the sea, even if they happen to have been educated to at least acknowledge that chaos at sea and in the construction of the flow of goods, constriction of the flow of goods and resources is a fast route to conflict and war from seabed through space. History has shown that in the background, it isn't a question of could, but if America could turn its back on its navy, as it has before, or that it could lose its status as a dominant global power. I mean, that is the argument that many of us in our country are trying to make. The system works because the Navy has worked. And if we are going to let the Department of Defense allocate monies, we're going to give a third to the Air Force, a third to the Navy, a third to the Army, whatever. We're going to do it all instead of thinking about what the real needs are. That seems to be a fundamental problem. And if I were Australia, if I were New Zealand, if I were Great Britain, and I'm looking at who is the power that is allowing us to have the free flow of goods around the world, I'd be pounding on my own government. Hey, look, we've got to look for ourselves here. And I don't know if that's happening anywhere other than that, we do have some voice in the U.S. They're sometimes not very well-heard voices.
I think if you were to look at this just from the island nations, and I'm going to pick on Australia, Japan, and Britain, what the continental nations do, and let's say what American sea power does, to some degree, I'm not going to say it's irrelevant, but first and foremost, what does the state need defense to do? And in the case of the island nations, one, well, it's always anti-invasion, basically. Two, then, is we're sea dependent. Now, that's just to keep your home safe. Those are the two things you have to address. And we're in this kind of embarrassing scenario where relative order at sea has been maintained by American sea power. Now, some could argue if America chose to draw up the bridges and say, we're out, where does that leave the island nations? And I think from a more Royal Navy point of view, that is quite embarrassing, because you can argue the United States Navy for much of its career is ultimately, how do we beat the British? How do we have a Navy second to none? How do we reach the zenith of our power and then build on top of that? And then when the U.S. Navy becomes really the leading American sea power, the question that taxpayers should be asking, well, why are we carrying all the weight? And the sea powers, the island sea powers, need to be able to turn around and say to continental powers, say, look, we do have our own mission here, and that has to come before anything else. Now, I think it's fair to say the problem is by asking America to take all of that, we're now seeing a scenario where taxpayers are asking, is this good value? The American fleet is stretched, and other nations are not stepping up to it. The people who should be there is the island nation navies, and you'll see it, and you've seen in Japan, I think, and Australia, they are definitely embracing a national maritime strategy. They are investing in their navies. The more concerning one with the Royal Navy is we are still here, keeping in mind that British shipping has just been sunk, and the defense budget is not going up, and actually investment in the Navy is actually pound for pound declining still. So what we're still seeing is the continental orthodoxy that was falsely advertised to the government since the 1960s, this land-centric thinking, this single, very NATO focus that threw sea power out the window, that rejected 300-year strategic experience, is still very, very strong. And that's where really the sea blind, we come back to the sea blindness argument, and why I think in the 1980s that naval officers tried to use this and saying, well, what is going on? What do we need to do to reverse this? But there's a bigger thing going on here, is that our parliament and our decision makers and our civil servants have been part of a Ministry of Defense and been educated to the point of they don't have to make any serious decisions because it's just easy to fake it as a continental power. Well, a nation that pretends to be a continental power, we can look to Japan in this in the Second World War, loses. And that's the trajectory which you can argue Britain is on. If you look at perhaps the Red Sea scenario recently and everything else, Britain's instant response should have been a significant naval response, and actually it was very lackluster. So that is a complete collapse in the priorities. And I think the baseline I should always say, what does the state want defense to do? And the point you made there is very important, because you can turn around and say, what the state has asked the Royal Navy to do since the 1960s, it has executed, and it has delivered. The Falklands War was a success. It's day-to-day jobs. It's done very, very well. What the real matter is, does the government know what the best solution is and provide the best options for national defence? And that's the one that we really get down into, that Britain is faking it as a continental power. I don't think you're seeing that in Australia and Japan, by the way. There's very active maritime conversation there, which is saying, look, you know, we've only got X amount of resources. We need to look after ourselves. We need to work closely with our American colleagues. Let's get on with it. In Britain, you're not seeing that conversation.
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention Japan. You know, one of the notes that I made to myself is in the first paragraph of your 19 February article, you said, quote, at a time when civilian scholars and senior naval leadership still had experience from a period when nation and government were educated to understand the fundamentals of an island nation and why the Royal Navy existed, unquote. That's been lost, and it's hard to get some footage on that. But when you look at recent steps by the Japanese and the South Koreans as well, and with AUKUS, the Australians, there is, in fits and starts, almost a renewal and an understanding of what it means to be an island nation or a nation that's prosperity relies on access to the open seas, whereas it's very frustrating when you look at, even from a distance, you know, you would think, you were talking about the arguments in the 1980s after the Falkland Islands experience, that you would still have to make an argument about the importance of being able to have that effort at sea. But it is, it's still there, but we have seen indications where in other nations, there can be a little bit of renewal that kicks off.
I think what's really confused, and what was confusing in the 1980s, was that there was actually quite a few maritime events going on, which is not just the Falklands War. There were things like the SS Great Britain at the heart of the Industrial Revolution and shipping as we know it and be. That was coming back to be preserved. The Mary Rose, King Henry VIII's flagship. The father of the Royal Navy. They had found the wreck, and there were lots of maritime things going on. And yet, on the other hand, the government's still saying, well, you know, we're not going to invest in the Navy. The period, that sort of halo period after the Falklands War, is actually very short-lived. So there has been this confusing that there is a weight of history, and almost to the point of arrogance, I would say, that everything will be okay. No, this is a long-term rewriting of history, which is communicated to our decision-makers that national strategy in Britain is not maritime. The threat on our doorstep is Russia. And what goes on in other places in the world? Well, you can see that in documents in the 1960s. Quite literally, the government says the Royal Navy's job is to remain in the North Atlantic. American sea power can do everything else, so don't worry about it. Well, now we can turn to history and say the Royal Navy has never been consigned really to the North Atlantic. It's right the way back to the period of Magellan and being and exploring the world. The Royal Navy has been active in every ocean because at that time, the Admiralty community had quite clearly to government, where do your resources come from? Where does your oil and gas come from later on, obviously, and things like that. And that worked very, very well. What's interesting about the rise of sea blindness in the 1980s, those senior naval officers bringing that issue up, they are the last of the Admiralty educated and trained officers. They have been around the Admiralty Secretary, whose primary job is to go into cabinet and say, this is why you have a Navy. So you can see that collapse, if you like, in how to deal with this problem. And they're bringing up this issue. They're raising the red flag and say, we have a problem here. Do something about it. And why I partly wrote these articles, which you sort of commented on there, here we are now 40 plus years later. The flag was put up saying there is a problem, and that problem has not been addressed. It's not to say that there were not initiatives to try and deal with it, but I think we have to admit they have been a failure if today both our Navy cannot communicate what it does, but also the awareness of the sea is still at rock bottom. So there is something very fundamentally broken compared to, and we've got, I think we have to be mindful of Australia and Japan. They have a threat on their doorstep,
and they are feeling the heat from it. Is there a naval threat to Britain from Russia? Well, you can toss that up in whatever direction you want to. The threat is always seen as a land issue. What's very interesting about the land issue in the British Army and the Rhine, which was really one of the key arguments to create this continental orthodoxy, was that the idea that the British Army could hold back the Soviet forces from charging across, obviously, Europe for a period of time for America to arrive in force, which was complete nonsense. And the Army admitted that to the Royal Navy, but they went ahead with the RAF to try and convince them to a continental commitment. Britain has never been able to hold off a large continental force. That's the difference between an island and continental powers at the end of the day. We cannot get engaged in massive land conflict. So there's an awful lot of historical baggage behind all of this. And one of them, I think, is very interesting to your point, is that the ligaments we used to have in communicating sea power have not been rebuilt, even after all this time of saying there is a problem. I think that's partly because our naval discussion is actually driven by naval officers who speak in technical terms. And when they write in the newspapers and when they try to address this, they're not talking in a language that our public and our civilian decision makers understand. And this is why you had civilians and historians like Sir Julian Corbett. It's why you had the civilians of the Admiralty, because ultimately they could translate that complex technical business into something very understandable to Parliament in very basic things as well. It's not difficult to communicate why the price of your fuel at the fuel tank goes up because your ships are being sunk at sea. It's not difficult, but we can't even do that today. So the picture, I think, is really grim in Britain versus Australia and Japan. I think what's very interesting on Japan is Japan switches from falsely being, I think it's a continental power, back to that island nation mindset, which really actually happens with American help. Admiral Arleigh Burke was quite central to that. Australia is doing the same, versus we've not had that discussion in the UK. Inter-service rivalry plays a huge part in all of this. There is this idea that I think to some degree that Britain not having the ability to have a large land conflict damages our national prestige. This is all essentially the perversion of historical facts to try and justify them that has happened since the 1960s.
Yeah, I think you've touched on a couple of really interesting things. One, there is the impact of NATO and its ground war focus, essentially for Europe, and the European Euro government, the one that Brexit took Great Britain out of. Also had that focus on, we're here and we have to worry about something coming across Poland to get us again. And talk about that a little more, because I think that plays a huge role in why the focus shifted from the wooden wall of protection that Britain had in 1805 to what we've got today.
Well, what's quite interesting is really the idea that Britain engages in large continental wars is one that is completely in the face of all strategic experience. Yes, the British Army proved itself over many centuries, but it essentially didn't do it without the Royal Navy. I've always joked, the Battle of Waterloo behind Wellington was a pile of naval officers because that's how he got there. That's how he was able to form that alliance, because security of Britain had been being secured by them by the actions of Lord Nelson. And there has to be an element for islands to be selfish and turn around and say, no, we don't have the resources to do these things. We have to defend the island first. What NATO provided for the British government, and I think very lazy military thinking, was to take away any ability to have to think about defense. Because it's quite easy to say, we're going to join this alliance, we're going to provide these things to that alliance, we'll let the Americans deal with everything else, and that will be essentially our national defense. Now, there's some really keen points on this. I mentioned one earlier, the idea that the Royal Navy should be contained in the North Atlantic goes against hundreds of years of experience, because anybody who understands anything, the logistics, the sea dependency of an island nation, you know, these things come over far, great distances, and you can't just keep yourself in the North Atlantic. The other part from that, I think, is phenomenal. This land-centric thinking was always a ridiculous idea of Britain, because where are the resources going to come? We all know that if you want to understand warfare, the first thing you understand is logistics. There's a great argument I'll quickly cover now that I put in my thesis, in where the Admiralty admits, the War Office, the British Army, and the RAF admit to the Admiralty that the concept, and this is what government is being told is correct, it can hold off the Soviet Union's armies in time for the American forces in bulk to get across the Atlantic in just 4 days. 4 days. That's without presumably the Soviet Navy intercepting it. And we all know, I think 4 days is a little bit of a stretch. On top of that, what are the Soviet Union going to be doing in this time as well? So there are whole piles of, in the 1950s, of arguments for saying, well, the nation is in decline and we have to accept this. The easy way out here, we don't have to make decisions about too many decisions. If we join NATO, we basically say, let's provide an army and an air force to it. The Navy basically gets shunted into purely an ASW role in support of the United States, and we hand over national defense to the Americans. And I would argue there has to be an element of reality here that island nations have to be selfish, and it's not about fighting a land conflict, it's about protecting their sea dependency first and foremost. How are you going to get the resources to Europe to do a fight? They're going to have to come by sea. Of course, the RAF did not want this argument put forward at the time, because they wanted to argue for their investment, and their investment, apart from tactical nuclear weapons, was one that they, along with the British Army, could buy the United States time. Of course, this is completely unrealistic, and in papers they admit it's unrealistic. The prices, however, are running down the Royal Navy. And then since then, when the Royal Navy tries to, in the 1960s, reverse course to be a global navy, it's ultimately shot down and said, look, the government's not going to pursue this, because NATO, our primary defense is NATO. Well, NATO is a continental idea for continental nations to work together. It doesn't prioritize the defense of an island in any shape or form. So what you have in this is a birth of very lazy defense thinking. And the military in particular, the government, really lose the ability to learn to know things that it knew yesterday. And this comes back to this institutional memory and corporate memory I said. In the space of a matter of years, all the things that Britain had learned and hard fought for over 100 years is thrown out the window. Simply because it's far easier to just have an army and an air force and say, well, we'll do something in Europe to support our European colleagues, and that's about it. There is a flip side of that, which is, of course, the Royal Navy is successful in the decades afterwards. So the public are led to believe that there is nothing wrong. We're now seeing that, I think, because of events and the growing chaos at sea, there clearly is a problem with British sea power. And it's making the nation incredibly vulnerable. And, of course, the public at the moment are very sensitive to the things that impact the money in their pocket.
Yeah, it was nice to see HMS Diamond and HMS Richmond over the course of the last 2 months, you know, put on a good show. But, yeah, the follow-on questions when you talk about logistics, support, endurance, relief, there is some stuff to be educated there. Now, but before we ended the hour, I wanted to give a chance just to give you to talk a little bit about some lessons for Americans about some of our heritage, and relatively recent is, you know, let's look at 1949, for example. You stated, quote, if it weren't for King and Forrestal and other visionaries such as CNO Arleigh Burke, Hyman Rickover, along with other civilian and military personnel, in the two post-Second World War decades, the future in which navalists in the U.S. Navy and Marine officers had to navigate would have been far more troubled. We had leaders at the right place at the right time to making arguments such that the challenges we have right now aren't as bad as they could be here in the States. What were some of those characteristics that those individuals had that future leaders could look at Or is it more of a situation that the structure in 1949 was such that it could give those types of personalities a little more room to the left and right to be able to make the fight an argument?
Yes, I think there are this is quite interesting because it really goes right the way back to the foundation of the U.S. Navy. And I commented there, I think a bit, it almost came across a bit flippantly about how the U.S. Navy ultimately is formed because, you know, the Army didn't want to deal with administrating anymore. It's too much of a hassle. But what really happens with the foundation of the U.S. Naval War College is establishing the mechanisms to communicate what American sea power is for and how useful it can be to the state, to the country type of thing. That's a very basic argument. Now, individuals are going through an educational program which is instilling into them at the War College and everything else that two key points. The first one is American sea power is always easy to argue against versus Britain because you're trying to say, well, you know, we're a continental country. We've got to think in land terms most of the time. There are questions about what we want to do abroad and what is important to us abroad, so that's not particularly the priority. So you end up with a period of navalism that is naturally developed, which is communicated to Congress and put out there to say, right, sea power is a really useful thing for the nation to have. These individuals who are there in 1945 have been through the system and they've been taught the key thing, which is the consistent and coherent communication of what American sea power is for and why the sea is important is in their mindset. It's why when the creation of the National Security Act, the DOD comes along, they fight so fiercely to say the U.S. Navy has to have the ability to have a voice. If we go down the route of having a DOD organization which says everything is so centralized to the point that the Chief of Naval Operations, the Secretary of the Navy, get rid of some of your post for a star, but they cannot honestly answer to Congress without being penalized and answer these questions, then we've lost our voice. If we lose our voice, American sea power is in deep trouble because there's going to be nobody to turn around and say, look, this is really important to the nation and actually has proven already that this is of great benefit and gives our decision makers the options that they need. And also there is now this responsibility that America's taking on its shoulders. Arleigh Burke finally said whether or not they understand it is a different matter. But those were the things they were trying to guard in the 1940s and 1950s. My argument and the research I've done is to turn around and say these unification wars, as I call it, the creation of the DOD for the U.S. Navy are not about aircraft carriers. They're not about equipment and budgets. They are first and foremost about protecting the ability for both military and civilian personnel within the Navy Department to be able to communicate honestly to Congress about American sea power. If those things had not been protected and if they had not pursued that policy, we would have ended up with a very different structure of American defense organization in which it would have been a lot harder to argue from a position of strength to why invest in the Navy in the future. And that's critical because although you can say yes in the 1970s and 80s and so on and so forth, it's not been sometimes easy. It was easier because at least there was an ability to have a voice to Congress and a voice to decision makers. Arleigh Burke's efforts in 1957 to stop President Eisenhower so centralizing defense that half of these things would be taken away was probably actually his greatest achievement. I know others would argue it's the things he brought in technically with the U.S. Navy. But no, that's the whole period of the 1940s and 1950s is protecting the ability for the U.S. Navy to have a voice. And that's really important because we come back to a continental nation really isn't interested in sea power because the argument would be, well, we can feed and fuel ourselves. And Arleigh Burke, of course, also has the advantage in the late 1950s where suddenly the populations which are far away from the sea get a rude awakening that actually the Soviets can land something on their head in their farms and their houses far away from the sea. So actually we need to have the ability to create a buffer zone. And there are other arguments that he puts forward at the time and says, obviously, let's stop tinkering with defense organization and get on with the business of national defense. And he was absolutely right. His achievement, however, was to say that your senior leadership can go in front of Congress and not be penalized for speaking the truth. So that is the ultimate outcome of what is nearly 100 years worth of learning about sea power and having an education system which your naval personnel are put through
to then go to get into senior office. CNO King is the prime example of that, to turn around and say, hang on a moment. Our primary mission here is forget to some degree the fleet and all these arguments. We need to make sure we've got a voice, because there's going to be a time that we will have to go to Congress and say, we need this equipment, or chaos at sea is going to not only just directly affect American national security, it's going to destabilize the world, and we will get dragged into dealing with those problems. I think the bigger picture to wrap on this is, naturally in Western liberal societies, we have other priorities, and we went from having a position of strength to opening the door to chaos, and now we are actually now going to have to deal with this. So again, we're back to a continental Prussian orthodoxy that, you know, you can build your tanks and aircraft and quickly, and you're talking tactical terms versus the Navy, which is that long-term chess piece. And it's about consistent, coherent messaging and investment over that period of time, because you're trying to keep some form of dominance, and unfortunately that's not what happens. The point is, today at least we can say this in the United States, and we can have this conversation, while that isn't in other countries. So the great achievement of those leaderships is really naval public relations at its base level. And that's why I've always said 1940s and 1950s, as I call it, are the unification wars. They're not really technological wars. Of course, people start talking about nuclear reactors and all the technical aspects. No, this is at a baseline. What is American sea power for? That's the important thing of the period.
Yeah, I think we get so lost in some of the technical arguments with our predominantly STEM-based Navy source that we forget you make the argument really with the other side of the brain for most people. But James, it's been a great hour. Really appreciate you taking time to come on and join us. If the listeners wanted to keep track of you and what you're working on, where's a good place for them to look? And do you have any projects that you wanted to give us a little hint about that might be coming down towards the second half of the year?
More than welcome to follow me on Twitter and connect on LinkedIn. Project-wise, I'm actually working on two books, one which talks about all of this problem, but also the creation of the UK Ministry of Defence and Department of Defence, where I talk about the devaluation of the sea, the abandonment of maritime strategy, and that's coming in two separate titles, because my PhD thesis was a joint sort of American and British one, and I've now had the opportunity to separate them out to two separate titles. So that's in the pipeline. The bigger picture in all of this is now trying to talk about maritime strategy and national strategy, and now we have experience in all the domains from seabed to space. I think having a more open conversation about maritime strategy and offering up the arguments now by using hundreds of years of strategic experience now is really important. And I think this is where historians really need to sort of ride to the rescue a little bit and try and put in that bit more of the philosophical and cultural arguments and come in on this debate. And that's something that I'm trying to help with an awful lot. So I've got two books building on all of this, hopefully, which will lay it all out in quite a bit of detail, following the American and the British model, and there'll be crossovers in either book talking about the two navies and how they develop and how they're different. The big one of the Royal Navy is it ironically becomes a little bit too much like the US Navy, and that's no good to an island nation, which feeds into all of this argument. So those are my two big projects at the moment.
Well, that sounds brilliant, and we're looking forward to seeing those books, and wish you the best of luck with them, and thank you very, very much for coming on. It's been a very, very interesting show.
Pleasure.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, we hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. The sweetest girl I know.
make a difference.